Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Stephen, and on a special episode of the New Statesman podcast, Anoush and I, fresh from Labour Party conference, discuss our impressions of it, and you ask us about May and Corbyn's Euroscepticism. Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Anoush.
We've just got back from being on, well, actually, I was about to say the world's worst delayed train. We actually, I think, on the second of the delayed trains.
Not even the first one.
But we were definitely on the funniest of the delayed trains from party conference. So the power went down in something which obviously actually is notionally the part of the nationalised railway, but of course, you know, confirms in people's mind the idea that there's a problem with how railways are, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, I will be sad when Jeremy Corbyn gets rid of privatised railways, simply because it will presumably bring an end to the world's most brilliant bit of human for theatre, which we had on the...
So the woman who sounded very nervous when she was announcing our delays, because she knew that she had a train full of journalists and politicians, probably. But she, earlier in the journey, she had announced all of the different foods and drinks that were available in Carriage C, where the train cafe was. And everyone looked, you know, okay, yeah, I'll have something to eat maybe in an hour or so. And then she went, but there is a problem. And everyone was like, what? The problem is that we can only take cash. And this just had Stephen and I really annoying the people around us by just giggling for the entire trip.
I think because she went on for so long that you could... Yeah, I mean, this was a detail. This was a hard sell, right? I mean, you could very easily have made your way all the way from first class to that time before she went. But by the way, because it's 2018, none of you can use this. they also, when we stopped us at rugby, decided to open the doors and let people go on the platform. Of course, neither of us were stupid enough to fall for that trick, because they, of course, did not tell people when the train started moving again.
Yeah, and then they suddenly started blowing the whistles and there were people coming and shouting at the closed doors on the platform.
Which, I mean, I know we shouldn't find funny, but it was just...
It was just so predictable.
It's amazing, just like, why would you trust this company not to do that?
So over an hour later than we should be, we're back in the office. And probably all of these stories sound ridiculous to you because we're overtired and overjourneyed.
But I think the interesting thing is actually the thing we do have in common is we're not depressed.
No.
Which is often the weird thing I think about covering any party conference is you do hugely absorb the mood of the conference delegates.
Yes. I've been going. I don't know how long you've been going, Stephen, but I've been going to most of the conferences each year since 2012 when I first started working in political journalism. And you're so right. Every conference you go to, you just end up being in the mindset of the delegates that are there because you soak up the sort of groupthink. And I've only ever really been that happy coming away from Lib Dem conference because they're all so friendly. But this year, I'm upbeat after the Labour conference. So that must tell you something about the mood there.
Well, actually, the one where I was upbeat after, other than the Lib Dems, where they're mostly just, you know, very cheery, very happy to have seen one another, is weirdly Tory party conference in 2014. When, you know, when it was quite a flat, dull conference and then Cameron, like, unexpectedly gave... just a really good speech, you know, just really well delivered.
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, and like that. The last hope, the last chance. It was one of those things where, but it was sufficiently good and they were sufficiently into it. Then like briefly by the end for about 10 minutes, I was like, yeah, I hope we smash them, smash the Lib Dems, smash Labour. And then after about 10 minutes, I was like, wait, what? What just happened there? Yeah, I mean, I think so. Obviously, conference delegates were having a good time. There was not quite a. I actually think, in an odd way, it had more of a party atmosphere than last year because everyone was so tired last year.
Yeah, yeah, because last year you'd think it would be the most sort of euphoric Labour conference for the past 3 years. But actually, yeah, there was. And there was also a sense last year that the main conference was slightly hollowed out by the festival that goes alongside Labour conference these days called the World Transformed, which is the Momentum created fringe. And I felt like that sort of took away slightly from the main conference, which it doesn't anymore.
Yeah, it's odd because that really ought to be the reverse because obviously in Brighton, the conference venue and the World Transformed big set piece events were actually closer together.
Exactly.
Yeah. Whereas the World Transformed was spread across a large chunk of Liverpool and the conference venue is itself on the docks. But somehow it didn't feel like it had drained all of the energy from the main event. So, I mean, you basically did the kind of fringes and I did the sort of conference floor and the wrangling on it. So what was your kind of impression from?
My impression was, well, pretty much what I just said. I think the fringe the Momentum fringe has started working with the conference quite well. So they're kind of complementing each other. They were saying that anecdotally they thought that there were more people who had Labour conference sort of lanyards going to these events. And they also had people like Ed Miliband speaking and obviously lots of the Shadow Cabinet speaking. And some of their events felt like real go-to sort of fixtures for more traditional political journalists to go and cover. Whereas in the first year, they felt the problem was that political journalists would go and cover these events just to make fun of them or to try and nick a news line about anti-Semitism. And, you know, we had events this year at the World Transformed called things like decolonizing yoga and origami for peace and that kind of thing. But none of that got the sort of sniggering that it would have had in the past. Instead, people were going to go and watch these events where they had really interesting speakers. They also had a lot of international speakers like Mélenchon and people from the Democratic Socialists in the US that drew big crowds. So
can I have a brief whine about JLM's
presence? Of course you can, yeah.
And George has done a very good interview with JLM, and there is a very plausible chance that he could become France's next president if things fall the right way for him. But to me at least, it does kind of feel like Burqa Banners should not be invited to Labour affiliated events. It was weird and strange when a bunch of people on the Labour right went, Manuel Valls, great guy, and it's just like, let me tell you a thing or two about and it's even more weird because at least people hadn't really heard of Manuel Valls. Most of those people were not aware of some of the views they were endorsing.
I
just do kind of feel like, particularly because it's not as if, right, from a radical left perspective, it is not the English left which needs to invite people from outside to go, here are my thoughts on how to be a successful movement. So it's incongruous for many, many reasons. And also, yeah, Burqa Banners shouldn't be invited to Labour conference.
Harumph. Okay, yeah. So there should have been some no platforming then.
Yes.
No, but I think one of the effects of this conference meant that you had a little bit of the same kind of cultural exchange happening on the flip side. So you had more, I don't know whether you noticed, but you had more sort of Momentum figures, people who are high up in the organization at the main conference and coming to some of the sort of more traditional social events at conference, like Our Party and The Mirror usually has a party on the last night. And there were people going to that too. So I think there's been some swap over as people discover the...
Yeah, I mean, it really felt like, so the last time we were at Liverpool for Labour conference would have been 2016.
Yeah.
Immediately after that second leadership election and the party, you know, emotionally drained, but weirdly the kind of old party establishment still very dominant, you know, in terms of their physical presence.
Yeah.
This, I think, really did bring home the fact that it is Corbyn's party now. His hegemony is near, as total, I think, as a Labour leader's can ever be institutionally, because obviously there are many constitutional powers granted to the trade unions councils, MPs themselves, all of which slightly limit the power even of a very strong Labour leader. But it is essentially his party now, and it did very vividly bring that home in a way that 2017's conference still had enough of the old sort of establishment in positions of influence that it hadn't quite. And I think that to me, I guess, would be, kind of, if we were doing take homes from conference, that would be one.
Definitely. And I think that that's proved by the fact that the division, if you wanted to find divisions at this conference, was not between the people who you'd call moderates and the Corbynites. It was between the left-wing groups on Brexit. And so that sort of suggests how the left is now an institution, you know, because the divisions were among them rather than between, you know.
Yeah, I think you
Blairites and whoever's.
Yeah, it definitely, most of the kind of big divides, kind of the things that actually animated people, the level of selections, what's the unique role of trade unions in that?
Yeah.
Effectively a debate being played out on the left of the Labour Party, in which the Labour right or the centre left or moderates, whatever language you want to use, were essentially wholly peripheral figures.
Yeah.
I think there's an interesting dimension to the, I think some of those rows didn't get written up in the way they perhaps will in the future, because you still have a large chunk of the kind of political lobby who view the Labour Party's divides through its kind of pre-2017 lens.
Yeah.
And obviously those divides are still existent, but I guess it would be a bit like covering New Labour in 1994 and going, oh, but of course Jeremy Corbyn doesn't like this Labour policy. Well, that is just irrelevant, really.
Yeah, exactly. They are the minority group. They are the eccentric fringe.
So it is a kind of complete transformation on those. The other thing is, of course, the policy platform, I think, this year has caught up with the rhetoric, right? The weirdness is in 2017, the 2015 and 2017 manifesto is the interesting obverse, right? In 2015, there's lots of radical stuff in Ed's manifesto, but the overall tone is, but don't worry, guys, I'm serious. I'm not going to do anything too wild. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about it. I've got that big preamble about how, fiscally conservative I am. You can trust old Ed. The 2017 manifesto is basically the 2015 manifesto with some nationalizations, but instead of having the I'm really sane, it's the I'm radical me. The big shift is tonal. Now, of course, as far as moving voters, the tone actually matters a lot more. The average person does not pay attention to the warp and weft of policy. Mm. But now the warp and weft of policy has moved as well.
Yeah.
This is kind of very much the same ethos as the message of 2017. But the policy platform is now significantly more radical.
Yeah, definitely. And I was at a Fringe event last night where John McDonnell spoke, and it was a rally on the Fringe. And he was saying that this year they're doing the manifesto, but it's a radicalized, version of that. So they're actually doing that consciously and saying that's what they're doing. But I think that that's what they're saying to their audience, who are their members, who they want to, they keep saying that they want their membership to sustain them through power. If Labour ever gets into government, they're sort of entreating their followers to stick with them just in case they need to make compromises, which of course they will have to. But I think some of the things that they're saying about their policies are almost trying to make them sound like they're not that radical behind the scenes. So I heard a front bencher refer to John McDonnell as now a neoliberal sellout, because basically his policy with the workers' dividends policy is more like a sort of bonuses for all rather than a bash the business type angle. And the same with Jeremy Corbyn's speech as well. The green jobs revolution that he came up with is a pitch to those leave voting constituencies, which have been deindustrialized but haven't had anything to replace that work. So I do think there's kind of a conservative pitch as well.
Yeah, I mean, so the kind of the strategic choice that this conference that has been made by the Labour Party is to pitch for leave voters. So lots of the panels I was on, you'd either have a question or the explicit topic was, what seats are you going to win? And obviously all of the MPs would go, well, we should win every seat. Our values are universal, et cetera, which of course the MP kind of has to say. But when you actually look at where they're putting the ball tactically, they've clearly decided, you know, the thing that they can bolt on to their 2017 coalition are people who voted to leave, who either did not vote in 2017 or voted for the Conservatives, who they can pull over with a kind of, because it's very kind of radical policy, very, you know, kind of very sepia filter kind of tone that they've got going on. I mean, in some ways, I kind of think the other sort of weird thing about this conference was the determination of a lot of people, activists, members, Corbynite shadow cabinet ministers, Corbyn skeptics, shadow journalists. Yeah, I think three of the things I was invited on to, you know, do TV punditry on, one of some of the questions were, you know, oh, have we seen Pete Corbyn? Which is particularly surreal because obviously we are about to go off to Birmingham, where we know that there is this big kind of meteor of dynamite heading towards the UK, which the Conservatives may or may not successfully divert. And it just feels so strange to have people going like, well, let's discuss how the next election will pan out. Yeah. Just, I mean, we know that this big, huge, politically climate-changing event is going to happen. And until it happens, it just feels slightly redundant almost because we just don't know how that's going to, how they're going to get out of that particular mess.
And that was the problem last year as well. I do remember speaking to sort of Corbyn allies in the shadow front bench during the election and afterwards, who were basically saying, well, this manifesto, we won't, you know, it's not really real because we don't know what we're going to be able to do after Brexit. So although you get these really interesting policy offers that have come out of Labour conference, and of course it's signaled the way that they want to go and they're sort of walking the walk of their radical talk, you don't know whether they're actually ever going to be able to do any of it. In fact, you know, it's unlikely that they will.
Well, this is the slightly odd thing about all politics at the moment, because I think it feels that there's, so, you know, the kind of central prediction of most people in politics, which I think is, to be honest, actually just people's optimism talking rather than any kind of action, is that, you know, there'll be some kind of fudge and we'll end up with a kind of not real Brexit. Mm. Well, in that case, there will be, I think, some quite restrictive strictures on state aid, various sort of bits of economic radicalism than they might otherwise do out with the single market. So that changes things in quite a big way. And also the structural reasons why it's becoming harder to win parliamentary majorities for either side will not be changed by that type of Brexit. Obviously, if you have a kind of catastrophic Brexit, then I think suddenly all of the kind of, you know, Pete Corbyn has, you know, how does Labour win over seats in this part of the country or that part of the country will become redundant because, yeah. Bluntly, if there are riots over avocados, then the opposition wins a big majority, I think, regardless of circumstances. But again, if the government inherits riots over avocados, then their domestic priority will be getting to stop people punching each other over avocados. It does have this kind of slightly weird thing that effectively, yeah, we all know that the Conservative Party is going to do something, but we don't know what. The thing I want to ask you is the other, we talked a little bit about Brexit and, of course, the weird way that, despite the fact that economically the Labour Party has changed, in terms of who runs it, the Labour Party has changed. The thing which hasn't changed is the use of conference as a cudgel for the members to go, we want coffee. Mm-hmm. I think what you want is for Jeremy Corbyn to be able to order a drink. Maybe it'll be water. Maybe it'll be tea. Could even be coffee. We're not ruling out coffee. And it's just, that is weirdly the one bit which hasn't changed. But the kind of interesting thing that happened in the speech was a kind of a softening of Labour's language about the final deal, you know, an indication that they could vote it down. In the spirit, and we should never end this without saying at least one thing which ages horrendously badly. Do you think that is actually a big change in Labour's Brexit position?
I don't, because I think that these six tests that they want the government's Brexit deal to pass were designed so that Labour can justify not voting it through. And also, Labour is the opposition. It is going to have to, I know that it hasn't opposed previous Brexit votes in the past, but it is going to have to vote down this deal. And I don't think that's been a realistic shift in the outlook. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, in the slightly bad for radio, because I completely agree with that. I think, the six tests have always been a way to kind of put a gloss on going, oh, we're the opposition, we're going to make your life difficult. Now, actually, the odd thing is I think that there is, this slightly surprised me, but this is something that, having sat in on a couple of focus groups and gone, and things I've kind of gone, it's like, well, look, what do you think Labour's position on Brexit is now?
Yeah.
And in almost every time I've asked, I've got a kind of like, you stupid kind of facial expression back. And they've gone, well, they're the opposition. Their policy is to be difficult. And I think, slightly to my surprise, people, despite the fact that, all of us kind of, most of the kind of, the consensus discourse, kind of, people are, that Labour's policy is ambiguous. Weirdly, I think there is much more, expectation than people think than the opposition will just find an excuse to be difficult. Yeah. And they will, of course, vote it down.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I can't see any situation where they wouldn't.
They'd have to be bonkers. I mean, what would be what is the incentive, right? Because partly, of course, they'll do it for lack of any other options because it's the one thing which will unify the Labour Party. Isn't her deal is bad? Whether you're a Brexiter or a Remainer in the Labour Party, you will think her deal is bad. But I also just cannot work out why it would ever be in the interest of the Labour Party to dip its hands in the blood, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah.
Like they have, it has never, you just cannot come up with a plausible reason why it's in Labour's interest to be a co-architect of Brexit.
Yeah. No.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
And this question is from Henry Mendoza. So obviously a great deal of coverage of the Labour Party's position on Brexit goes through the lens of Jeremy Corbyn's historic Euroscepticism. Of course, Theresa May is also historically dabbled in Eurosceptic ideas. So why, why do people not consider Theresa May's historic Euroscepticism to be as relevant?
I think the main reason is because people like to focus on Jeremy Corbyn's Euroscepticism because they think it makes him look like a hypocrite, even though they're wrong. So my main reason for saying this is because people looked in very simplistic terms at the new membership of the Labour Party and their majority. They were a majority pro-Remain. Then they looked at Jeremy Corbyn and they wanted to sort of undermine his connection with his own membership by saying, oh, but look, he disagrees with you on Europe. So that's why I think lots of people focused on that as if it was some kind of news or some kind of revelation, even though that's been his position for decades. I remember I interviewed his brother once, Piers Corbyn, and one of the lines in the interview that got the most pickup was that he said that he remembered all of the ways that him and Jeremy agreed on Europe, which was to be against it. I was quite surprised by, because I thought that if you cared about Jeremy Corbyn or if you knew a lot about politics, then you would know that that was, of course, his position. So basically, I do think that focus on his Eurosceptic history is basically as a stick to beat him with and to try and disappoint or disillusion his supporters.
Yeah, I think because the problem that Corbyn sceptics have at the moment is they see a membership where they have this 60-40 at the absolute outside, probably due to differential, people leaving and people joining. Probably actually now, if you reran that election now, but imagine that everyone who's currently in the Labour Party had been around to vote in the Corbyn versus Smith, it'd probably be more like 80-20 because of Corbyn sceptics leaving. And so people, it is partly, I think, when people look at the European thing and they go, okay, well, this is the one, what is the one thing about me that is closest to the members? It's this.
Yeah.
And it does, I think, create some slightly confused commentary of what I think of as the why doesn't Corbyn have the courage of my convictions genre. Where it's just like, well, because he doesn't share your political aims. I guess I actually think in some ways, I think so mostly, of course, when we get asked questions like this, I go, the problem isn't the Labour Party has a reasonable bar to clear and the Conservatives have no bar. This is actually one of the examples where I actually think that it's really tempting to see Labour's Brexit position to the perspective of the thing about Jeremy Corbyn, which is unusual for a Labour leader, which is that he is Eurosceptic. However, actually, that's not really that relevant to Labour's Brexit position. It would be identical under Yvette Cooper or Andy Burnham. It could potentially be different if Liz Kendall had won, you know, a thumping landslide, but if she had won narrowly and had to reach an accommodation with her opponents, it would be the same. So it's not that different. And actually, the thing about him if matters on Europe is the thing about him which is most like every Labour leader, with the exceptions of Tony Blair in one direction and Michael Foot in the other, which is that Europe is not an issue worth losing votes over. And then, yeah, and effectively the position which allows them to, you know, use no political capital and hopefully to discomfort the government is the position they will take. And the reason why we don't cover Theresa May's historic Euroscepticism is, I mean, I, to be honest, kind of think actually her Euroscepticism is only interesting if you are partly seeking to explain the 2016 result, which is that she is one of a wave of Tories for whom going, oh yeah, I'm not into Europe, me, was just like a way of showing that you were sound.
Yeah, just for their association.
Yeah, and that sort of background cultural hum of sort of anti-Europeanism, I think, was a huge factor in the referendum and a huge sort of cultural tide that has got to be turned back if we are going to reverse Brexit at some point. And at the moment, just no one has really started to even think about what turning that tanker looks like.
Mm.
But we don't cover Theresa May's Euroscepticism because people rightly know that it has naff all to do with the Brexit position she takes. It is mildly interesting if you're talking about Theresa May's thought. And in lots of ways, I actually think Jeremy Corbyn's Euroscepticism is like that.
Mm.
It is not integral to him in the way that, it's not like, say, you cannot explain the decisions Jeremy Corbyn has taken and the associations he has made in Labour's anti-Semitism row if you do not understand the centrality of Israel-Palestine to his politics.
Yeah.
Whereas actually understanding his Euroscepticism is not central to his European politics or indeed his politics in general. So the answer is neither of them should be given any coverage. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleague Anusha Kellyan. It's recorded by India Bork and produced by Caroline Crampton. Our music is Devil by the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. If you've enjoyed this New Statesman podcast, please do subscribe. If you haven't, remember that we are very tired. and any criticism may well make us cry. So don't get in touch on Twitter or Facebook to do so. Anyway, we'll be back next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.